Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We don't often associate children and anxiety, but it is an issue that affects one child in eight. The issue is going to be discussed this evening at the Ethical Society in an event sponsored by the St. Louis Psychoanalytic Institute. Featured speaker is Dr. Barbara Milrod. She is professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and is on the faculty of both the New York Psychoanalytic Institute and the Columbia Psychoanalytic Institute for Treatment and Research. She is an associate editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Dr. Barbara Milrod joins me in studio, along with Lenita Newberg, a faculty member at St. Louis Psychoanalytic Institute, where she directs its Advanced Psychodynamic Psychotherapy Program. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us. That was really a mouthful.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Milrod, let me begin with you. I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that anxiety is a significant issue among young people. What's going on?
Well, it's not new. Kids have been anxious for a long time. I think that we are becoming more aware of the prevalence and the deleterious outcomes of anxiety. Surely kids have crippling anxiety. There is a question about whether it's more prevalent now than not. But I don't think we have a definitive answer.
Well, what's making them anxious?
So many things make kids anxious. Kids can be frightened of things that stem from their individual experience. But I would say that people in our culture in general, in this country at least, are more on edge. And what grown-ups respond to filters down to kids, often without grown-ups meaning it to filter down.
And the time we're living in right now is one that would certainly encourage anxiety, I would think,
on the parts of
young and old alike.
Yes.
Yeah. How about locally? What are we looking at here? Is we right in line with everybody else across the country?
I don't know that we have statistics on that, but good heavens, you don't have to be you'd about have to be in a little tiny cabin in the woods to miss that there's so much going on. And in a 24-hour news cycle, when we've had the Michael Brown incident and the Stockley verdict, and then we've had all the stuff that's going on nationally and people getting news on a 24-hour basis that just 5, 10, 20 years ago, we didn't live with. And what people often forget is that for little kids, they don't really understand that if it's going on in the background and you're watching a video for the 20th or 40th time, the child, especially a very young child, might not even know that that's not current. We may be waiting for an update through the news, and the kid may just understand that there's anxiety, and they're like little radars. So if they know that the parents and the adults are scared, they can get pretty terrified.
And Dr. Milrod, watching the television is what's presenting these videos over and over again.
It's not just TV. It's the internet. It's the way people talk to each other. Yeah. People, there is a level of incivility that is tolerated in our culture right now that is not good for kids.
How does it present itself?
Anxiety.
Yeah.
Well, we have a formal diagnostic manual that becomes less and less exact the younger the person is. But kids... They sometimes complain of physical pain. They have trouble sleeping. They're nervous. They feel like they can't eat. Sometimes they feel like they can't be separated from their mom or dad or home. Things that had seemed less frightening suddenly seem scary.
But Lenita Newberg, I would think that many of those symptoms, if you will, wouldn't necessarily point to anxiety. I mean, kids being kids, there are a lot of things going on in their lives. It'd be hard to pinpoint what the problem is.
Well, it can be hard to pinpoint, but if you're a kid, if you're an adult who's in that child's life on an everyday basis, you probably have a sense when something is changing. If this child is starting to act qualitatively different from the way they've acted in the past, we need to stop and say, hey, buddy, what's going on? And have a real talk. Tune in. Very often we're paying attention to behavior and managing behavior, as opposed to what's going on with this kid inside that might be precipitating this change.
When we use the word child, what are we really talking about? What age range are we talking about here?
Well, I don't know what we're talking about. Kids and teens, we're talking about, certainly anxiety presents by the time kids are verbal. Mm-hmm.
But it would be different, I would think, in, you know, a 3-year-old than a 13-year-old.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very, very different.
Yeah.
And different worries, different sets of concerns. I think the younger kids have much more trouble reading anything other than just the affective tone of what's happening in the home.
Right. So I think we've established that the television, the news, if you will, of the day, and anxiety within the household are probably the two biggest contributing factors.
Well, Dr. Milrod has done the research on that, so I'm not entirely sure.
No. But
I'm not sure about that. I think it's far more complicated. And I don't think we'll come up with a simple answer. There's a genetic component to anxiety.
Huh.
There are people who've studied this for years, and this goes way before any of the current nonsense that's going on. Certainly anxious people are more likely to have anxious children. And then there's an environmental component. And there's often a combination of the two in anxious families or anxious and depressed families.
Well, just explain the environmental component, if you will.
Well, let's think about what is anxious parenting. Mm-hmm. So, and this has been studied. So certainly there are a number of things that have been linked to higher levels of childhood anxiety. So an anxious parent who says, oh, no, don't eat more than one piece of Halloween candy. You'll get a stomach ache. If you've got a nervous, anxious, genetically predisposed child anyway, who's been listening to you be nervous till now at age 7, she's going to think, oh, no, I have a stomach ache. So that's a small example of sort of transmitted anxiety sort of environmentally. But there's other stuff. Having a depressed mother in particular can raise a child's anxiety level. And I think another thing is sort of how well do parents cope with a child's anxiety? I just want to say parenting is a roller coaster. There's never a right answer. There's always 1,000 things you did wrong, and all you can do is try to do your very best with the knowledge that there's no perfect response. But being unable to tolerate your child's anxiety aggravates anxiety.
So what do you do then? If you've got a child that does have a problem, what does the parent do? Or is it the parent who has this responsibility? Should it be the teacher or somebody outside of the household?
Look, I think when we're talking about kids, the primary responsibility, as we all know, is with the parents.
But what does then the parent do when they recognize this?
I think, you know, there's little things and big things. So if it's just a small disturbance, things like what you were talking about earlier, sort of just talking to the child and letting them know that you care and that you're interested and that they can talk to you and that they don't have to be frightened to talk to you is important. And also not crediting the disaster fantasies. You know, there really aren't monsters under the bed.
Yeah. What about medication?
What we have found in our field is that medication is often just so overused. There is a place for it, but I am not a physician. I can't even prescribe. And what I'm hearing increasingly, I'd say in the last decade, is more and more people coming into my office saying, I don't even want medication. I've watched too many of my friends or my family members on medication, and it doesn't seem to work very well, and they get all kinds of side effect profiles that are pretty crappy, nobody wants to have to live with. So, again, yes, there's a place for it, but when you can understand what's going on inside of you and you can change yourself from the inside, and that's the work that we do as psychoanalysts mostly. If I understand a lot more about what my fears are, what my anxieties are, check in with reality, learn so much of what is in our minds is unconscious. And we have studied this field for, well, more than a century's worth of treatment history to say, what's going on inside and how can we handle it that doesn't require medication?
I ask this question because we have a caller who is going to raise the issue of medications. Let's bring in Jesse, calling from St. Louis. Jesse, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. It's interesting because I pretty much just reflects my life almost exactly, except for people kind of started realizing something was a little off with me when I was probably 9 or so. My parents, both susceptible to depression and anxiety. My grandfather killed himself because of it. Mm. So when I was about 9, like, they started with things like having me write in my diary why I was upset or why I was depressed, any kind of internal thing, but there was no reason, and there continues to be no reason. It's just, that's just the way I am. So I always think it's interesting that, like, I was put on medication in my early teens. I think it's interesting when people tell me, well, why don't you just exercise or why don't you do this or think more positively? Because then I'm like, well, cool. Now I'm just outside and depressed. Medication has been a blessing for me. Mm-hmm. I think it's silly that we would tell people, you know, with something like diabetes, just don't eat this. You could just do this. When, you know, so many of us have tried all of those things, and if there's a genetic component, you don't, like, I think it's silly to make people feel badly about using a medication that allows them to function normally in everyday life.
Jesse, let's get a response to that.
Thank you so much for calling in, Jesse, and you actually took some of the words right out of my mouth. How old are you now?
Well, I'm 27 right now.
Oh, you're a grown-up.
I appreciate you guys.
Right.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys actually bringing acknowledgement to this issue that it's not something that kids are just making up.
No, they're not making it up. I want to talk to your point about medicine. We sort of have a little disagreement here on the panel. I am a psychiatrist. And there really, we don't have a ton of research, clinical trial research outcome data in kids, but there was one enormous landmark study called the Child Anxiety Multimodal Treatment Study that was run in 6 sites. One was not in St. Louis. And really what they found was that medication, and they were using an SSRI.
What's that?
So serotonin, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and there are a number of brand names that basically all function similarly. But they found that more than half of the kids got better just from medicine. And I do have to say, if we're thinking about a giant public health problem, which I do consider this to be, no one's really able to answer the question about whether it's a growing public health problem or it's been under-recognized. And we don't know the answer to that question because the research hasn't been done. But I would say sort of bang for the buck, get somebody better quickly. Not everyone will respond to medicine, but it's worth a try. These are very safe, very well-tolerated medicines, and I see no reason not to try.
What does the medication actually do?
That's a good question. And if I were a, you could hear all kinds of fancy answers about the brain. And there have been imaging studies and, you know, what actually changes with SSRI use. I don't think there's a good, clear scientific answer to that. It clearly changes the amount of serotonin available at receptors. That much we know. What does it do clinically? Hmm. It doesn't change your personality. It doesn't change your thoughts or who you are, but it makes you less depressed and anxious. What I always say to patients if I'm giving them medicine is no pill is going to make you 100% better. You started getting anxious when your parents were divorced or like Jesse, you've had stuff in your family. I mean, you know, no pill can take that away. But if you feel less anxious, you are more able to think about these things in a less catastrophic way.
The word depression has come up a couple of times in our conversation, Lenita. Is depression normally, usually associated with anxiety?
Very, very frequently. Normally, I think overwhelmingly, yes, but not always. So they are, I mean, we use two different words because they are two different things.
Yeah.
But very, very frequently happen together, sure.
So antidepressants would be a part of any medication regime?
These are the same classes of medicines that have been studied. They were first studied in depression, and then later they moved to anxiety, and they were studied in anxiety as well. I would say the older a kid gets, the greater level of depression comorbidity. Mm-hmm. You know, it depends on your population, what you see. Somewhere between 20 and 50% mm-hmm. of anxious kids are depressed. And what we do know, and this is important and disturbing, is that the kids who also get depressed when they're anxious have the most complicated outcome. Mm-hmm.
Lenita, are there degrees of anxiety?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, what's the range?
Well, from I'm getting a little bit nervous about going to school on my first day, I suppose, to truly debilitating anxiety can be where somebody can't leave the house, where you can get physically sick. Don't forget that we're starting to understand in medicine, I think, a little bit more that what we feel and what we experience emotionally can ultimately precipitate a lot of just a cascade of physical problems. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Milrod can speak to the medical side much more than I, but the range is just phenomenal, just life.
But it would seem to me, Dr. Milrod, that some of this, I don't know what percentage, is normal. I'm concerned
Absolutely.
About going to school, a brand new
that
school.
That is normal.
Sure.
That is normal.
It's still anxiety, but...
Anxiety. Anxiety is ubiquitous. But an anxiety disorder is not ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. That's when it sort of takes on a life of its own mm-hmm. and kids...
Controlling.
...can't live mm-hmm. the life that they want. When they're making decisions based on anxiety rather than choice,
yeah.
That's a problem.
We have another caller here. Let's bring in Kathleen as time is getting away. Kathleen, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm visiting St. Louis from Phoenix, Arizona, and I am a medically fragile teacher. And what we've noticed over the years and what struck me is about just the lack of data, because we are getting more and more children who are out of school that we have to deliver services to that aren't out because of cancer or another debilitating physical problem, but because of anxiety and depression. And they just absolutely won't leave their rooms. Mm. And it's wonderful families. There's, you know, initially people want to say, oh, what happened to their childhood? What are their family life about? Absolutely nothing. There's absolutely nothing wrong with their family life, and the parents are at wit's end. Suffering myself, I'm an advocate of all modalities of body, mind, and spirit. And I appreciated the other caller calling in and saying, don't deny us the opportunity. If there is an SSRI that works for us, don't tell us to get a better attitude. Don't tell us to go exercise and do more yoga and meditation. because then we're just a sweating, depressed person.
Kathleen, if I may ask, and again, time is getting away, I've not heard this term before, a medically fragile teacher. What does that
Correct.
Mean?
That came in when the laws were passed with the wheelchair ramps. My mind is forgetting the name of it. It was passed during the Clinton administration. It had to do with offering assistance to handicapped, and it's part of it's a federal law, and all schools need to deliver services to students who are going to be out of the classroom for 3 months or more. So if they're going through chemo, they're in a horrible car accident, and they're going to miss 3 months in a row, the school districts are bound by law to deliver services to them in their home or at the hospital.
I see.
Fascinating, huh?
Yes. Yeah, well, it certainly is. I mean, it's opening a door that I've not looked through before in terms of just at risk, how at risk kids are without people like myself not even knowing about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you want to respond to anything that Kathleen said?
That's quite a story that there are so many kids who it sounds like they're being homeschooled now because of depression and anxiety. Kathleen?
So bad. We have one student that wouldn't leave his bedroom and had a tent in his bedroom.
We've only got about 15 seconds left.
Oh, we have 15 seconds. I'm going to say that it sounds like there should be greater medical services. It sounds like a solution that is probably not ideal.
We can tell folks they can learn more about this tonight at the Ethical Society. It's 7 o'clock. That's the Ethical Society on Clayton Road. Dr. Barbara Milrod, our guest here, will be speaking at that gathering. And also I'd like to thank her for being with us, and also Lenita Newberg. Thank you for being with us.
Great to
talk to you. You've opened a few eyes today, I'm sure of that. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.